Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for sticking around for the last session of the day. I'm sure it's been a long day, and hopefully you'll learn a lot about hybrid exchange in this afternoon's session, which is what we're here for. So we're going to talk about simple migrations all the way through to hybrid migrations. We're going to show you some demonstrations on how that works all going to plan. So my name's Toby Knight. I did a session earlier today on ADFS, so I'm going to build on that for those of you that were in that session. And I'm the Microsoft Office Technical Specialist based in New South Wales. I'm joined on stage by Chris Goosen, who is one of our valued partners. He works for Ansys. He just recently completed his Microsoft Certified Master in Exchange 2010. So he's one of the best guys in Exchange in the country at the moment, so most recent and up-to-date skills. So welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Toby. Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming out. I know it's the last session of the day. Everyone's keen to get those beers in. I believe Toby's actually buying the first round tonight, so should be pretty good.
Yeah.
Thanks again. I'm Chris Goosen. I'm quite happy to be sharing the stage with Toby today. We're going to teach you guys a little bit about Office 365 and hybrid environment and how that all works. Can everyone hear me okay in the back?
Cool.
Okay, excellent. Before I hand over back to Toby, just a couple things. Firstly, hands up, anyone actually playing with this stuff at the moment? Has anyone actually configured a hybrid environment? Anyone sort of getting their hands dirty a little bit? I see a few hands out there. I'm a bit blinded by the light, so excuse me, I see some hands out this side. Excellent. That's good to know. I mean, hopefully what we're going to show you guys and present to you guys is going to be helpful in that path. Secondly, we've got some great little giveaways today just to keep things interesting. Want to make sure that you guys get the most out of the session, but we also want to kind of keep it a little bit fun. So, through the course of the session, we'll be handing out some great gear. Plantronics have been very kind and sponsored us some nice headsets, like this one over here, and some other ones. So we're going to be handing those out during the session. At one point during the actual session as well, I'll ask a question. I'll kind of pre-stage it a little bit, but ask a question, and I think we'll do a bit of a Twitter, sort of a Twitter answer there. So first person in with the sort of session code hashtag and the right answer gets the Jabra Voyager Pro, the Plantronics Voyager Pro. So that'll be quite good. So look out for that as well. And that's not the full session code as the hashtag, so just the last bit. We'll be looking for that. So I'll hand over to Toby to kick us off.
Yeah, so feel free to ask questions as we're going through. It's late in the day, so anyone who asks a good question, we've got about seven or so headsets from Plantronics, different types that we'll give away. So feel free to ask questions as we're going through, and we'll give those away. So today, what we're going to cover is, number one, planning around migration. So what are the migration options? When is it most appropriate to use particular migration options? And we'll go through some user cases about that as well. So we'll show you what cutover and staged migrations are. Chris will actually do a cutover migration live on stage. And then we'll look at the hybrid components. We'll look at the hybrid, we'll show you an example, we'll do some move mailboxes and things like that. So planning. Can't see that. So the first thing you need to do, when you're looking at cutting over to an online service, and we talked about a lot in the earlier session, it's all about planning. You've got to understand, all the things that you need to understand in regard to the service that you're currently migrating from and what the end state needs to look like. So you need to take in consideration your directory, your current messaging platform, and the capabilities behind that messaging platform that you need to replicate in the cloud. Absolutely critical. So to do that, there's a lot of documentation available, and we'll show you some of that later on, but make sure you have a really good understanding of what you're trying to achieve and what your outcomes are going to be. The second thing is preparing. So preparing, especially when you go down the hybrid environment, is all about establishing the ADFS infrastructure. It's about establishing the directory synchronization, but it's also about implementing your on-premise environment and ensuring that that is functional and operating correctly. So you've got to test your mail message flow, the coexistence components, the replication of free busy information, and all those types of things. And then we migrate. So typically what we find in a typical enterprise migration, and I think about that as greater than 2,000 seats, typically that kind of project, whether it's migrating from Nodes or Exchange 2003 or 2007, or whatever platform that is, Typically, we can get from start to finish in about 6 months. However, around about 4 of those 6 months is around planning and preparing. So the actual migration, and we like to do velocity migration, is really done really quickly. So we can, and we do quite often, have a lot of good examples of doing high velocity migrations whereby we're doing users in groups of 400 or 500 and we're doing that 3 times a week. So if you're a 4,000 seat organisation, as long as that organisation can cope with the state of change, then from a technical perspective, you can actually migrate that whole organisation in a couple of weeks. Most important, to make sure you're successful though, is to make sure that you've done the plan and prepare phases, very importantly. And the last state is decommissioning the old environment. Let's go through this. So the factors that we need to look at, number one is what's the source? What's the email platform you're migrating from or transitioning from? Then how big is it? How many users do you have? What's the mailbox sizes? Do you have an archive attached to that? All those type of questions you need to really understand. What applications integrate into that existing mail platform? Then you need to look at, you know, when I move forward, how am I going to approach identity management? Is that identity going to exist in the cloud? Or is it going to be, you know, your Active Directory on-premise? Is that going to be the source of truth? Are we going to implement Directory Sync and ADFS and those type of components? So you really need to have a good understanding of that. Not only that, but you need to understand how that decision impacts the other services that you're providing within your core infrastructure. So am I connecting to other cloud-based services? You know, what's my integration to my financial systems? And, you know, how do I manage the source of truth for that identity on-premise? All those types of things. Then you need to understand, am I actually going to go down a hybrid path? Do I actually need to have Exchange on-premise as well? So we typically take you through a you know, consulting type exercise where we identify the dependencies on that system and then identify whether or not you actually need a hybrid Exchange environment. And some of the factors that, you know, may lean you towards a hybrid environment are things like data sovereignty. So there may be a group of users where you don't want data to go offshore. So in that instance, you would have an on-premise Exchange environment. You may need a compliance archive. So you may leverage the on-premise archive, the on-premise Exchange environment to be the gateway to your archive, whatever that is. It may be Enterprise Vault, for example. You may have some legacy applications that integrate directly via MAPI into the Exchange system. So we don't support MAPI in Exchange Online. So if that's the case, then you need an on-premise email box. And, you know, another thing that quite often comes up is that you may have some high-volume marketing-type mailboxes or some application mailboxes whereby they're part of the call centre and they're part of the workflow process within that call centre. So they have high volume. So we have some limitations around message flow rates and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of considerations. But once you've made that decision, you need to understand what you're trying to achieve out of that. Then you go into the provisioning phase. So, you know, once I've made all those decisions and factored in all those things, then, you know, what infrastructure do I need to put on-premise? And how do I do that? So how do you pick a migration solution? So cutover migration is a one-step process. So you may have, you know, up to, on this slide, we say up to, you know, 150, 200 users, where you're effectively cutting over that whole email platform in one go. So in that one move, you're migrating all the users' data, all their calendar items, all that type of stuff, and you're also moving pointing the MX record to point back into the cloud. And you may go through a staged migration. So in that instance, you've implemented DirSync, but you've got a bigger organisation, a little bit more complex, maybe up to 2,000 users, and it's not possible to cut all those users over in one step. So in that instance, you need DirSync in place. You need a coexistence strategy in place to manage mail flow between the on-premise and the online environment. And then you need a way to migrate those users in groups. So we'll talk about that. And then the final one, which is most common, is hybrid. So I'm moving off an Exchange 2003 or a 2007 platform. You know, I may have more than 2,000 users. So we've done some sites where they've got up to 10,000 users within Australia and a lot bigger worldwide. And what they've done is that they've implemented Exchange 2010 on-premise, and then they've migrated from Exchange 2003 and 2007, moved them through the Exchange 2010 environment, then up into the cloud. So the advantage of that type of approach is that, you know, you can really do it in a planned, methodical way. You can do high-velocity migrations as well, but from a free busy perspective, that coexistence and that mail routing is very seamless to the end user. So it's typically the approach that we see. So quite often we'll find that even if the end state doesn't include an on-premise exchange environment, during the coexistence and transition phase, there will be an Exchange 2010 environment in place. So let's look at the options. So the cutover migration, it's good, it's fast. The advantage is there's no service, no infrastructure required on-premise. So we'll show you in a second. You basically configure the cutover migration. You point to your existing mail platform, provide the right credentials, and then you just move those mailboxes across. You pull the data out. So it's very easy to do. It's very quick to do. And the planning behind that doesn't need to be overly complex because it happens in one place. And then we go all the way down to the hybrid environment, which we've talked about. So from a cutover migration perspective, the objective is to move the mailboxes as quickly as possible. So typically, you wouldn't go beyond 200 users as part of an organisation for a cutover migration. It says here less than 1,000 users. I doubt you'd actually do a 1,000-user organisation. And identity management will exist in the cloud, so there's no on-premise infrastructure at all. From a staged migration perspective, it's effectively the same process as a cutover migration. However, you do need directory synchronisation in place. And you can only migrate from Exchange 2003 and 2007. And you need to factor in message mail flow and mail routing as part of that process in regard to the transition period. So the things that aren't migrated when you're looking at a staged migration, we don't do security groups. We don't do dynamic distribution lists. We don't do the dumpster. And we don't do send as permissions. What we do is everything else pretty much. So we do tasks, contacts, obviously mail and message data, the calendar, and email delegation as well. So if you've delegated your account to other people, we migrate that across. So I'm going to hand over now to Chris to do a demo of the cutover migration.
Thanks, Toby. Right, so essentially what we're gonna have a look at is we have an on-premise environment. We're gonna do a cutover migration. So essentially, we're not gonna be relying on Federation or DirSync to provision or anything like that. We have a simple Exchange 2003 environment on-premise, and we want to move those users and their mail to an Office 365 environment. And I'm gonna talk you through exactly how that works, and we're actually gonna kind of do it live here on stage, so we hope all the demo gods are with us today as we try this. Before we actually get into that, let me just take a quick trip down memory lane. Who remembers that? Who's still using that? Hands up, anyone. We'll get you into the cloud soon. So if you may note the icons next to the mail or the messages are actually quite funny, but that's because it's actual RSS feed data in the mailbox, that's all. I just wanted to populate something in the mail in there before I migrate the user across. So like I said, it's an on-premise Exchange 2003 environment, proven there. I'm going to just log out for that user there and switch to my Office 365 tenant. So. What we have here now is, as you can see, this is the Office 365 admin or portal in the admin overview. We've obviously got all our admin tasks on the left-hand side and access to all the resources and everything on the right. So it's pretty well laid out. You can really find everything you need quite easily. I've pre-staged a few things because, obviously there are a few things like DNS replication that we can't really fudge too much on stage. So I've already added the domain. For those of you not familiar with that, it's a bit of a two-step process essentially. We'll sign back in again.
So while Chris is signing in, does anyone have a question? We'd like to give something away. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think so. You can delegate, but I don't believe the full... I would assume the full access doesn't get migrated across. Yep.
Is there a reason why it doesn't?
I don't know. If you send... I don't know the answer. So if you send an email to rab@microsoft.com, we'll collate that and get back to you. But that deserves something.
Something so, out of the goodie bag.
Yeah.
I think just to touch on that... essentially, when you're not actually connecting your two directories or environments together at all, right, as with a stage migration, there's no way for them to actually see that information. And that the component is usually done by the federation stuff, which is, you know, more of a hybrid solution. So, right. Thanks for that, Toby. Right, so as you can see, back to our demo. I've already added the domain in there and gone through the process of actually verifying the domain. For those of you who have not done it, it's really just you add your domain and you create an A record in DNS just to verify that you actually own that domain. So you'll see it there. It's h2003.gooselabs.net. That's the demo domain that we'll be using today. So that's already been pre-staged. I've added that in there. We can have a quick look at our users, and we'll see we don't actually have any users except for my admin user, which I'm currently logged in as. You'll notice the username is a little bit different. Really the next step is going back to the admin overview, and we'll actually go into the Exchange Control Panel, which is really where all the sort of nuts and bolts of Exchange or Exchange Online, or even really if you're using Exchange on-prem, this is where a lot of the admin takes place. So just log in there. Wait, what, that one to load up. As Toby mentioned previously, it's all a web-based migration, so we're not actually installing anything on-premise. We're just connecting to our on-premise environment. And you'll note that in order to do this, really what we want to do is we want to make sure that we have Exchange 2003 or Exchange 2007 with Outlook Anywhere enabled, or RPC over HTTPS, as we used to refer to it back in 2003 days. And really we're just connecting via that, and we're actually we'll provision and pull the mail out through that. So there's a really easy to find email migration button over there. And what we're actually going to do is we're going to create a new migration batch. And I'm going to say that it's Exchange 2003. If you're using Exchange 2007 and you have AutoDiscover configured, it'll actually go and use AutoDiscover to configure all the correct settings for you for Outlook Anywhere. So you don't even have to manually edit the enter the server settings. We thought we'd be, you know, do it a little bit more trickier here and use Exchange 2003 where we have to manually edit everything. So I'm just going to go ahead and...
So has anyone actually performed one of these migrations yet? No.
And what I'm going to do, excuse me, is I'm going to cheat a little bit. I know that I've got 7 mailboxes that I want to migrate, so I'm just going to have them all migrate simultaneously. Obviously, I would...
Questionnaire, yeah.
Right, you're talking about the actual, it's the Outlook, or the Outlook provider within the Exchange settings. So that's a really good question. I guess if, under the covers really what it's running is it's running a Exchange, the online connectivity verifier. So if you can pass that test online, this should work fine for you. The reason that you actually change the certificate and the MSSTD setting within Exchange 2010 is more for Outlook. It's a client-side thing, because Outlook wants to see the subject name and the first SAN name of your certificate to match. So it's more of an Outlook thing as opposed to an actual Exchange thing. I think you definitely deserve a prize for that question. So back to our demo here. I've populated all the fields in. Hopefully I haven't typoed anything. We click Next. And what it will actually do now is it actually is going to connect, and it's going to check that we've actually, you know, entered the correct settings, and it's going to verify those settings, and it's actually going to go and have a look at what we have in the on-premise environment. And it has failed. I must have probably just typoed something here, so give me 1 second. Yep.
No, that's not correct. No. So if you, DoSync is platform wide, so it's part of the service. So
yeah, but if you don't have Exchange, you can't put your Exchange admin in online services.
Yeah, so the DoSync will replicate your users from the on-premise AD up to the cloud.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, but where you go in to set up
DoSync
is in the Exchange admin area online, correct?
No, you set up
DoSync
on-premise.
No, I agree.
No, so once you've done your DoSync, you'll get a list of users.
Yeah.
Then you just click on that user, and if they only want SharePoint, you just select SharePoint for that user.
So logging into the actual admin panel on the online environment doesn't actually mean that you necessarily have to log into Exchange. And quite often what I do when I do these deployments is I create an entirely separate administrator user that doesn't have any licenses assigned to it. Because if you're allocating a license to that user and no one ever uses that mailbox, that's a wasted license.
Yeah, no, I didn't know the initial. Yeah, I would say you have to have one license
for Exchange. No, you don't, no. Okay. No. And you can buy SharePoint service individually as well.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Right, so back here, I actually have now I've got the correct password in there. It's actually gone connected to my server. It's seen that I've got 7 mailboxes there and 1 group to migrate. And I'm going to say, yep, that's pretty much what I was expecting to see. So now I'm going to click run. And what it's actually going to do now is it's actually going to start what's called a migration batch. And you'll see it'll actually, it's going to actually provision the users firstly. So it's going to create every single one of the users as it sees them. And then it will start backfilling the mail for those particular users. So this may take, you know, however long depending on your environment. There are a few things that are quite important here, and I want to sort of touch on those before we move on a little later. But you can actually see what's going on here through the PowerShell as well. So as you can see through the actual admin interface, there's a little refresh button here, and it will kind of refresh itself periodically, and you can see anything that's been completed, and it tells you what it's actually doing. But you can actually, for those of you who really love the PowerShell, as I do, and everyone else does, I'm sure, you can actually, by using the sort of get migration batch commandlet, you can actually see what it's doing through the PowerShell as well. So it gives you a little bit more information, as you can see, through that, and it tells you what it's actually doing in the background. This is actually carrying on here. Let's just give it a quick second. And it's still creating recipients here. I think one of the things I wanted to show you is, two things actually. Users can actually be created, and it will provision these users. As you can see, there they are. They've actually been provisioned for me into my tenant. They've been provisioned, but currently I've not actually done anything with regard to licensing. So there's actually a little error up there, as you can see, that says that there are no licenses there. So these users currently will not actually be able to log in. Now there's something else we need to do as well to enable them to log in, other than just assign them a license. And I'll get back to that in just a second, because it's quite important. I think lots of times people kind of get to this process and get very excited, because it's like, yeah, we're going to the cloud, but we're not quite there yet. We need to make sure that we actually complete the process. Like I said, this batch is actually running. It's created all the actual users for me, and what it's now doing is it's actually migrating the mail across. It's currently, as you can see, it's got some active mailboxes there, and it will actually continue to do that. An important thing here is that this process, once it's actually finished and it actually says it's migrated all the mail for me, the batch is not actually finished. It will actually run again every 24 hours, because if you picture the scenario where you actually have more than maybe 7 users, which I'm sure most of you do, your migration is not going to be that simple. By the time you've migrated one mailbox and it's actually all the mail content is actually sucked into it, a new message is going to arrive back in the old mailbox. So you're going to have this sort of time in this where you have mail at 2 different levels, right? So ultimately, what you want to do is before you actually after you've actually cut over your MX record to the cloud environment, you want to keep the migration batch running for a day or two just to make sure that you backfill any messages that have actually come in since you've actually completed the batch. So I just want to this shouldn't take too long, and actually just show you the whole process of actually, here we go. So we've got seven active now. They're all still doing their thing. Yep. No. We will get into that a little bit. Hybrid scenario is pretty different because you're actually doing most of the configuration from your on-premise environment.
Yeah, we'll cover that off in a minute.
Yeah, we will get there. It's, the provisioning obviously is pretty quick with DirSync, but I think as the guys alluded to this morning as well, there's obviously some considerations there with if you're doing, you know, more than 10,080 objects, you want to actually contact Microsoft because, you know, their times and particular windows and stuff like that they may want to for you to do that that migration in. So I'm not going to wait too long for this. It usually finishes quite quickly, but it seems that it's taking a bit of time. We may move on and just come back, and I can actually just show you how we go. Yeah, I think let's do that. We won't wait too long. We can see that we've actually got the users across. And I'll actually show you guys. So, as I mentioned, the users have been moved across, but they actually don't have any licenses assigned to them at the moment. Now, you can imagine in a large environment, and let's say you have a few administrators, it may be slightly tricky for you to figure out, well, how do I know which users need licenses and which don't? Well, fortunately, we can actually just change the view to show us all the unlicensed users, and it will actually give us all the unlicensed users. And we can bulk edit the users as well, so we can make sure that if we are moving over users or wanting to bulk edit a few users at a time, we can do that. And we can actually go ahead and actually, I'm not going to change any of those particular properties, but we can actually give them licenses. I'm going to change the locale as well because that's a mandatory setting, so it won't actually let me carry on without doing that. And I'm going to give them full licenses to everything because I'm a nice guy. And it'll actually go ahead and do that for me. We'll see the results. There you go. So that's all done. Let's have one last look here. Yes. Not in the cut over migration, no. Not that I'm aware of, anyway.
No, there isn't. It takes everything. From BPOS. So if you're migrating from BPOS Office 365, Microsoft will get involved and you'll be, if it's 6,000 seats, that process will be managed by Microsoft. So we'll actually transition the service onto Office 365 for you. Yeah. Correct, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we go through a long process with customers of that size to make sure that the prereqs for Office 365 are in place, the right software components are deployed and all those type of things in preparation for that weekend. A question there? Sorry? On premise?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a number of options there. You can basically export stuff to back into the user's mailbox prior to migration and then migrate it up into the cloud. There's some third-party partners around that offer online solutions to pull stuff straight from the archive straight into the cloud. And the other option is you just maintain that archive and use journaling to push... You maintain that on-premise archive and use journaling to push all email that you want to do on-premise for a compliance-type archive. So there's a couple of options there.
And I guess that all comes down to especially the flexibility with the hybrid solution, and that really that's kind of what the hybrid solution is all about, is making sure you're not pushed into a particular model. It's flexible and you can deploy it sort of to meet those types of business requirements. So just to finish off the demo. So the migration is actually completed. We can see the batch here says that it's actually done. The batch will still run until I actually click complete migration, which I'm going to do because we're not actually going to be having this backfill any further. And then there's one last step before we actually are able to log into these mailboxes. So we've assigned license keys. Can anyone have any ideas what we still need to do, what the missing link is at all, sir? Pardon? No, not quite. We do need to change the MX record for the mail flow to actually continue to work to the cloud. That's correct. But to actually be able to log into the mailboxes, that's not quite it either. So what happens is we've actually provisioned new user accounts. And so because we don't have any federation here, these are essentially new users and their IDs are now managed via Office 365. So we need to give the users their passwords because they now have different passwords. And that you'll note that every single step of the process, it asks you for an email address to send reports to. Those reports are quite important because it actually sends you like a little statistics file, CSV file, that actually contains the passwords for your users. And you know, without distributing these passwords, you wouldn't actually be able to do or get into your mailboxes. So that's pretty important. I have seen a few posts on the Office 365 community going, I've created these users, but where are their passwords? Well, this is where they are, and they're pretty strong passwords here. So I'm not going to even try and retype that one. I'm just going to quickly just show you guys just logging into the user's new mailbox just to show you that process before we wrap this up. I'm using a different browser, as you can see, for two reasons. One, it shows the sort of user experience with a non-IE browser, and two, it allows me to actually log onto Office 365 has two different users on the same machine. So, oh, come on. That's what happens when you try and pre-stage things. So I'm just going to give him a new password. And this is a user that was obviously created from scratch. We've just done the migration process, didn't exist before. And now within, you know, however long, it has got a brand new mailbox in the Office 365 environment. Here you go. And we can go back into the inbox there. We can install Link if we wanted to because we've assigned a Link license. We've assigned a SharePoint license so we can see the team site given the right correct permissions. And I'm just going to accept the defaults on that.
So you can imagine for a small organization, it's a great, quick, easy way to cut over to the new platform.
Yeah, and this is really where the sort of the planning really comes into play, because you need to make sure, A, you've planned some sort of means of communication, because you need to get users their new password, for one. Secondly, if users are using the old OWA URL to log in with, they're going to have no idea that things have changed, and they're going to need to know what the new URL is, because we're not actually doing hybrid here, where we can redirect and all that sort of cool stuff.
Yeah, move on to the hybrid stuff.
Okay, cool. Let's do that. I think we're good to go. Right, so what I'm going to talk about now is just kind of looking at some of the hybrid features just to kind of set the stage for Toby and his epic demo that's coming later on. I want to just compare, firstly, a stage migration versus a hybrid deployment. So we've just seen the demo of the cutover migration, which is really just a very simple, you have a few users and you kind of want to do it in a weekend and just get it done. The stage migration is a little closer to the hybrid deployment because really you're going to have coexistence between on-premise and cloud through sort of, you know, you're going to share a namespace, you're going to have a unified GAL through DirSync. And really those are kind of things, that's where it ends. You have so much more that's actually available to you if you're doing the hybrid deployment. And I'm actually going to group them into sort of feature sets. So we have exchange sharing or really exchange federation, if you want to use that term, which is really what we were talking about previously with regard to giving you free busy information and cross-premise mail tips and the OWA redirection and, you know, single OWA URL, all that kind of cool stuff, online archive, so you can actually have your archive in the cloud and your mailbox on-premise if you wanted. We have mailbox move, so I'm sure we've all seen Exchange 2010 has that very cool online move feature. So you can move a user's mailbox while they're still using it, and it would just cut them over at the last minute once it's all moved. And that applies to the cloud as well. So if you're moving a user to Office 365, same concept applies.
There's one feature there that's really important, which is the no OST resync. So you can imagine if you're migrating a large number of users, there's really two processes. When you do the cutover migration or the stage migration, you're migrating data up to the cloud, and then when the user logs on, if they're logging on using an Outlook client, the rich Outlook client, they're effectively creating a new Outlook profile, so they've got to drag all that data back down. With hybrid mode and a move mailbox, well, you migrate the data up, but we maintain the state of that OST, so there's no need to drag that data back down. And that has a significant difference in regard to the transition times.
Perfect.
You need, no, so the only component you need is the Exchange 2010 client access server. You need to make the scheme, you know, you need to add that server into your Exchange org. Once that's in place, you can migrate straight from your 2003, 2007 server straight through. So you just need that that CAS server in place. Yes.
And then, yeah, so that's quite important, I think. You know, I often get asked the question as well, what's the point of an archive if I've got a 25-gig mailbox? Well, the point is, if you have 25 gigs in your mailbox and you're not archiving that, you're going to have a 25-gig OST file. And that's a lot of data that has to come down to your client all the time. So that's always a good thing. And the last feature set really is secure transport. We want to make sure that messages sent on-premise to cloud and back from cloud to on-premise, messages are treated as if they're in the same org. So, you know, you want to pass all organizational headers across. You don't want those headers to be stripped out. You want to make sure that, from a security perspective, those messages are encrypted as they would be if they were sent between two on-premise servers. So that's the secure transport stuff. And we'll dig into each one of these sort of feature sets in a little bit more detail. Right. So the first one, and really what I'm going to do with these is we've got some screenshots here, and we want to sort of talk to some of the actual features, but I really want to, I'm going to kind of skip through these a little bit quickly. Please stop me if I'm going too quick. I know that Toby wants to actually show you guys a lot of the stuff, and we feel it's actually a lot more valuable for you to actually see it as opposed to just looking at a picture in a slide deck. So we'll just go through these. But ultimately, so cross-premise free busy. If you imagine the scenario where you have a company executive, for example, let's say you have a sales team, and your sales team have their mailboxes in the cloud, but you have your finance team and they're on premise because you need, you know, for compliance reasons or whatever, you need to keep their mailboxes on premise. What would happen if you didn't have hybrid configured? Essentially, if your sales manager wanted to set up a meeting with your financial manager, they wouldn't be able to do that. You would see their FreeBSY information would sort of be crossed out or grayed out. You wouldn't be able to see it. Whereas if you had hybrid configured, I don't know if you can even see the slight change in the deck there, but you would actually be able to see what their FreeBSY information looks like, so you would be able to tell if they're free or not at that particular time. And really, that's sort of one of the great features about the hybrid deployment. Similarly, mail tips, great for giving you sort of contextual information about a particular user. So again, if you picture, you know, someone being on-premise and wanting to send a message to someone who's in the cloud, if Outlook sees that person as being part of the same org, it will give them more information. So if they're away on holiday, it will give them their out of office. So you know, even though the user's in the cloud, you know, hang on, this person is on holiday, and if I send a message to them, it's probably going to come back to me saying, please contact such and such. I can just do that straight away. So it's really contextual and helps you to make the decisions before you actually send your messages. Message tracking, again, you know, Exchange 2010, we can allow end users to do their own message tracking without having to actually contact the help desk and actually log a call for it. If you didn't have hybrid installed, essentially Exchange will only track to its boundary, which is your perimeter, and you'll actually see it send you a message saying this message has been handed off to a third party, and we can't track it any further. But if we configure a hybrid environment, we can actually see that it will track it all the way to delivery, and it will tell you this message has been delivered. So very powerful stuff. Mailbox search, again, for those who have any sort of e-discovery or you have compliance officers that need to do mailbox searches for audits or anything like that. If you configure the hybrid environment, allows you to do that. If you don't have it configured, those users won't even appear in the picker list. You won't actually be able to see them at all. A pretty big one is unified namespace and a single URL for OWA. Now, I've seen a lot of talk about this myself, and I've had a lot of discussions about this as well, because for many companies, you've, you know, who've come from whatever version of Exchange, you've always had pretty much the same URL for OWA, mail.contoso.com, and your users have bookmarked it because most people don't want to remember it, they just bookmark it. Can you imagine then having to say to a user on a Monday, hang on, you now need to enter mail.outlook.com or mail.office365.com. You know, the user experience is severely impacted there. So what a hybrid environment allows us to do is we can actually make it seamless for the user. So you'll see in the screenshot there, it actually shows you a redirect message which says the following link, click the following link to open your mailbox for best performance, and it actually will just redirect them to the Office 365 tenant. But there's actually another way that we can do that as well. If we have the correct organization relationship and we use CNAME records, we can actually make it even more seamless for them. And we can actually give them a URL that's easier for them to remember as well. So it doesn't have to be an outlook.com URL. Because if you've just typed in mail.contoso.com and you see a message that says, please go to outlook.com/OWA, you're going to look at that and go, oh, is someone kidding? Is this potentially a security risk? So you can actually customize that URL using a CNAME record so that it actually looks to the user that it is actually something that they could click and not have to worry about. So that's quite an important one over there. Yes. Not at the stage. No, it will still be a redirect. So it will still. Correct. So what it will actually do is it will redirect them to. Ultimately, it's going to redirect them to your ADFS server so that it can auth them again, and then it's going to send you into the portal. And I guess that's kind of the trade-off as well is, do you send out a message to your user saying, you've now been moved to the cloud, you need to now use this URL, and then 3 months later when you move them back on-premise for whatever reason, you send them another, do you really do that, or do you just leave it as it is and just, you know, have the users? And I'm sure, you know, with time, as things progress, I'm sure we will eventually get to the point where it is a very seamless experience. But currently, that's the experience for users. So I'm almost done with these features here, so just wrapping up the last, I think this is the last one. Cross-premise mail flow. We talked about secure mail and making sure that we can treat messages that are sent between the cloud and the on-premise environment as coming from the same organization. And why is that important? I mean, really, do we really care? Well, we do, because for one, we can encrypt them, so we can make sure that all the communication between our two environments are encrypted. But for two, it gives us the ability to preserve those headers, and we can look at, for example, user information. So if you took, in the example in the screenshot there, Sally coexistence, without hybrid being configured, your Outlook client has no context about this user. It thinks it's an external user, so it's just going to give you their SMTP address. But if you configure the hybrid environment, now Outlook can resolve that user to a GAL, and you can actually see the user's full information, which is obviously such a bit much better experience, especially when you're supposedly users in the same environment or an organization. So really, in summary, what we're trying to do here is offer sort of near parity for features and experience for all users here. So make sure that those users that are, when they're in the cloud or whether they're on-premise, they don't really know the difference and that their experience isn't altered at all. On this slide, there are a couple of things I wanted to call out, and I guess this kind of goes into one of the questions here earlier today as well. What's not supported? There are a few things that are not supported or don't quite work at the moment, and it's really something that sort of a caveat, which really just, the takeaway will be to just plan it. And one of those things is delegate permissions. If you take the scenario where you have an executive and his EA, and she's been delegated permissions to see his calendar, if you move one of those users to the cloud, that those permissions will still move, but they will no longer work because they're essentially in two separate environments. So if you move them together, that's fine. It will continue to work as it always has. So really just, put a little thought into who you're moving and move them kind of in a way that makes sense for that kind of thing. That rings true for senders and full access permissions as well. You want to make sure that you're moving users who are sort of accessing each other's calendars and stuff like that together in batches. A big one, and I think Toby touched on this morning as well in his session, multi-forest. At the moment, we're only supporting single forest environments. So if there are multi-forest environments, I think it's obviously takes a little bit more planning. I believe that there will be a solution coming fairly soon. I don't personally know the roadmap for that, so I can't really talk about that, but I'm sure Toby will, if he has any information. Do you have any further information about that?
Yeah, it's being addressed at all. Timeframes as soon as possible.
Okay, so. Fair enough.
Yeah. No commitment, I'm good at that.
I was trying to do it and you just threw it right back at me.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So multiforest is not supported currently. And then lastly, public folders. We didn't have public folders in BPOS and we don't have public folders in Office 365. I think the general recommendation is if you currently are using public folders, I think we know that there is a bit of a blocker there for adoption. If you are using public folders, look at potentially using something more suitable. And I guess that's pretty much all I'm going to say about that. But the takeaway there is that public folders are not actually supported at the moment.
Question there, yeah? Migration. Yeah, there's actually partners around that do that, provide that kind of service, and there's some tool sets around. We don't provide that kind of service out of the box, but there's partners around that can help you with that. So obviously our recommendation is to move public folders to SharePoint. So. Yeah, you can either do a SharePoint internally or straight to the cloud. It depends on how big those public folders are, I guess.
I think just on that as well, Jim Lucy from the product team is actually busy putting together a white paper on that. So, and the white paper, I mean, I don't know too much about it, but he's looking at actually addressing this problem and actually just presenting guidance about and around how you would actually migrate your public folders into a SharePoint environment. So, yeah. Yeah, it's contextual and it's specific to what do you do with your public folders if you're wanting to go to Office 365. So that may, I don't think it's actually published yet, but it will hopefully be out soon and that will hopefully be able to give you some guidance on that. Yeah.
What's with service level agreements? Is that negotiated on whatever you sign up, any seats you get? I mean, if an email service goes down for, say, in our situation with the university, with the staff and students,
yeah.
Students could go a day or two without email services, but 2 days in the university without email services for staff, I mean, should it
be? Yeah, so the question was, are our service levels on the platform negotiated individually? The answer is no, there's a common service level across the platform. We have, they're published, we have, if you type in search engine Office 365 service descriptions, there's a bunch of documents there that define what that is. For an email, for example, we have active data center, so it's effectively real time with a 1 hour RTO on that. So it's probably a better service than most organisations are providing today. Going to move along a bit. We'll take a few less questions. We're running out of time a little bit.
Yeah, fair enough. We'll just quick on. I think just want to quickly touch on sort of what's actually required to get this to work. I think that's what everyone's asking. You know, how do you actually get this to work? So at the moment, we have two required server roles that need to be installed on-premise. The first one is your Active Directory synchronization, or your DirSync server, really, because that's what's going to be doing the provisioning for you. So at the moment, and I know we've had customers that have kind of asked about provisioning through other means and other methods, DirSync is the only supported provisioning mechanism or method at the moment. The second required role is an Exchange 2010 SP1 CAS hub transport server. And really what that does is that kind of helps with the Exchange sharing stuff. That also helps with the secure transport and the mailbox move stuff. So that's why we need that. On this deck, I've actually got it listed. Actually, before I move on, so here's that the Twitter question that I was talking about a little earlier. Basically, if you're using, so it's a required server to have an Exchange 2010 SP1 CAS hub transport. At the bottom there, it says mailbox role required for legacy environments. Can anyone tell me why that is? And I'll come back to answer it in a little while. But I guess that's the Twitter question for the headset. So first question through with that hashtag, first answer through with that hashtag, we will win the headset. I won't actually draw it now. I'll draw it at the end. I'll just wait for everything to come in, and we'll take it from there. I've got mentioned or listed on there one optional server role, which is your ADFS or Active Directory Federation services. Something to touch on with that is not the ADFS role on Windows Server. So you don't go into add server roles, click ADFS, install, and off you go. That is not it. This is ADFS v2, so it's a separate download from the Office 365 website. That's what gets you that. It's listed as an optional role because really you don't need it, but I don't know many customers are going to go down the whole route of configuring a hybrid environment but and not use same or single sign-on. So it's listed as an optional role, but it really is something that's pretty key because that enables your single sign-on. Another question we get quite a lot is, you're saying, even if I'm coming from Exchange 2003, I need to install Exchange 2010 SP1 on-premise. Do I have to buy a license for that? Well, no, you don't. If you have a paid Exchange Online subscription, you actually get that free. And I will clarify, it is an Exchange Hybrid Edition. So there are, I believe, some limitations regarding mailbox storage or being able to host mailboxes on it. We'll have to clarify the exact limitations, but it is limited to what you can do with it. But it is a free license, so there's no more cost or no further cost incurred from a licensing perspective anyway to be able to get this set up. Right. Do you want to go through the I'll go through the concepts?
Yeah.
Okay. So just to clarify how a bit of this stuff works and going through some of the core concepts, if we look at a normal standard Exchange environment where you're not actually hosting anything in the cloud, you just have your on-premise 2003 server, as we do here, and we have two users. A user, Toby at foo.com, is an external user wanting to send a message to an on-premise user at contoso.com. Toby sends the message to Chris at contoso.com, and the mail servers at foo.com do a look at the MX records and basically route mail through the internet accordingly. It's basically simple messaging, how that works. If you now add the environment where you've added this Office 365 environment in, and now we want to get this coexistence happening, how does that now work? Essentially, the on-premise Exchange server uses a subdomain of your domain to actually route messages between the two, very similar to any migration process that you may have actually ever done before. Generally, it's called service.yourdomain.com. You can obviously change it if you want, but I think from a standards perspective, most people just use service. And really what happens is, again, if we use the same scenario, foo.com will send it through to the on-premise environment. Once it sees that it's actually a user that's in the cloud, it just gets forwarded to the Exchange Online environment. And it's pretty simple. That's pretty much how it works. If we look at federation, I hear the word federation being used quite a lot. I think it's important that when we're talking about this stuff that we set some context into what federation actually means. We have two different types of federation, essentially. So we have single sign-on and ADFS and all that good stuff, which really allows a user to use their corporate credentials to sign on to cloud services. That is federation that can be used with, it's not specific to any particular service, and it works with all the Office 365 services. So whether you're using SharePoint, whether you're using Link, using Exchange, it's that federation. Then the other one, which is Exchange Federation, or Exchange Sharing, as I've heard it called as well, really is just a service access behalf of the user to access Exchange resources. And you can do this now if you have two organizations that are using Exchange 2010. You can use the Microsoft Federation Gateway, and you can actually federate your FreeBSD information without actually having the cloud involved. That's called Exchange Federation. I think I just wanted to make sure that we actually understand the difference between that, because the term federation is being used quite a lot. So if we look at how that actually works in the context of FreeBSD lookup, in a standard environment, if Chris wants to look up Toby's FreeBSD information, Outlook sends a request to the CAS server. The CAS server locates his mailbox server, and the mailbox server basically passes the request back and gets it back into Outlook. So all the work's actually done by being done by the CAS server and by the mailbox server, not actually Outlook itself. If we add the scenario of using Exchange Online, and we're now going to the cloud, we see that it's a similar process. Essentially, Chris's Outlook client will actually speak to his CAS server. The CAS server sees that it's actually that Toby's actually a user in the cloud, but that there is an organization relationship. And we're going to go into the organization relationship stuff a little later on, just talking about how that is actually set up, what an organization relationship is, and how the sort of federation with the Federation Gateway works. It actually sends the request for a token to the Microsoft Federation Gateway. The gateway will return the token. The CAS server then appends that information or that request to the token and actually sends it to Exchange Online. And the information is basically passed back to Outlook. Again, it's done all the work's done by the CAS server, and it communicates with the Federation Gateway. Very similar process with if we look at Exchange Online Archive. So If you have an on-premise user who's using an archive that is actually situated in the cloud, same process again. We actually speak to the Federation Gateway. The Federation Gateway returns a token to our CAS server. It actually appends that information to it and sends it to Exchange Online, and the hierarchy is returned to Outlook. So that's how we work. Does anyone have any questions on that? Yes. Sorry, could you repeat the question? Yes.
DNS, it can be hosted by anyone. There's specific records you need to put in place to get the configuration working, though.
Yeah. So if you have an Office 365P SKU, so that's the professional tenant, you can actually have Microsoft hosted DNS for you. But it's not required. You can have it. I don't think that that's possible if you have the enterprise SKUs anyway. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, so any of the DNS records that you need to create for this, you can go create them at wherever your DNS servers are. Obviously, you need to be able to support things like service records if you're going to be using Link, which a lot of the sort of internet DNS servers don't always support. But other than that, there's no real restriction to that. Okay. So we talked a little bit about the secure mail and how that all works, and I'm going to kind of skim through this a little bit so we can get to the demo. Ultimately, what we want to do here is we want to make sure that messages sent from our on-premise environment are seen by our cloud environment as being part of the same organization and are secured accordingly. And really how that works is by using certificates. So our hub transport server on-premise will have a mail.contoso.com certificate, and our FOPI, or Forefront Online Protection for Exchange server, will have mail.messaging.microsoft.com. The two servers will actually form a TLS connection. So when a message is actually sent, my message didn't flow. I had a little... Anyway. When a message is actually sent, it actually sees that the message is coming in from a source that it knows. It can match the certificate name to the actual FQDN of the server, and it knows it's secured, so the message is encrypted. We want to obviously set that and make sure that all our messages sent between the two environments are secure. It's otherwise known as domain secure. You may have noticed a little green tick in Outlook, and that's kind of what that is. Same concept of just sending our internal headers to the cloud. It uses a TLS tunnel, so we know that because we've already got our TLS set up, messages that are sent will actually, the header information is attached to the message. FOPI will actually see that it's come from a source that is trusted. It knows that it's trusted, so it will actually append the certificate subject to it, and that message will make its way to the end with the correct header information still intact. Again, we can do that in exactly the same way in reverse fashion to make sure that messages get from the cloud to on-premise. I'm going to kind of skip through this one, just see people are getting a little bit restless. But it's exactly the same process, and it just works the opposite way. I think this is the last scenario I just want to talk about, and this is a centralized mail flow scenario where I think we were up here talking about potentially having an on-premise archiving solution. And really, this is what the centralized mail flow scenario caters for. If you have a reason or a need to capture or journal or archive or do anything to your messages before they actually get to the cloud, we can do that by having all your mail flow on-premise. We can also have all mail flow on cloud too if you wanted without going to the on-premise environment. And really the way we do that is we have our TLS tunnel. We just set up our connectors to make sure that our FOPI connector only receives mail from on-premise and only sends mail to the on-premise environment. So it won't actually allow mail to flow there directly.
So we'll move over to demo now.
Let's do that.
Yep.
I think we're pretty much bang on time, actually.
What number am I on? Number two.
But we're not actually bang on time, but... So are we going to just skip forward a little bit because that's the wrong machine?
Me.
Is that you? Yeah, that is you. Cool.
That's me.
Sorry, we're just going to skip forward so we can show you guys the demo. I think there's a lot of value in actually seeing this stuff without actually looking at the slides.
All right. So what we have here is I've got an RDP session to a lab down in Sydney, and on this environment, we have all the core infrastructure components that you need to complete for rich coexistence or a hybrid exchange environment. So in that instance, we have a DirSync box there, and that's, you know, just replicating our identities up into the cloud. We have a domain controller, obviously, which is our source of truth, our on-premise domain controller. On there, we've also got the ADFS server configured. So the ADFS server, you know, Chris said there's two levels of trust. ADFS is at a user authentication level. So we've got a trust relationship set up to our online tenant there. The online tenant in this instance is stuau.com. It's just an online tenant that we have. We also have an ADFS proxy for external access. So if I need to authenticate to Exchange or SharePoint or some type of service like that from externally, then I go via this ADF proxy. So from an Exchange point of view, we're not going to go through the configuration. There's actually a lot of steps to set up the ADFS component and then the Exchange Federation component. What I will show you, though, is a great tool that we have, which is at teched.microsoft.exchange.deploy, xdeploy 2010. And you basically go here, and it's a tool that lets you, that helps you determine what the steps are and what infrastructure you need on place. So you'd come here, and if you're doing a hybrid environment or a cloud-only environment, it'll take you through the process. So we can click on hybrid environment, and we say, you know, what are you migrating from? So we're going to migrate from Exchange 2010. We've got an on-premise Exchange 2010 environment. And then it asks you questions around, you know, where do the credentials live? Do you want both on-premise and cloud credentials? You know, where do you want, how do you want mail routing and all that kind of stuff? So we can click yes, yes, yes to all of those questions. And it is different based on those requirements. So again, the plan prepare phase, absolutely critical. And then you go in here and it basically gives you a checklist. So again, for prepare and plan and all those type of things, it really helps you guide through that process. So it gives you a checklist and, you know, it gives you some architecture diagrams and some examples based on our stuff of the type of infrastructure you need in place. It tells you how to configure, you know, what the configure, the prerequisites are there. You know, there's some dependencies around when you implement ADFS, there's some dependencies around user principal name and making sure they're not using a .local domain and all those type of things. So there's ways to address those types of challenges. And then it goes in and tells you how to configure that. So there's a bunch of different ways there, and you really, there's a lot of steps you need to take within PowerShell at the moment. The good news is that we're on Exchange 2010 Service Pack 1 today, and I think there's about 51 manual steps to get Exchange deployed in a hybrid or federated mode. When we move to Exchange Service Pack 2, which is due out very soon, it moves down to about 5 steps, and it's all wizard-based. So it's a significant improvement because it really was quite complex. Although, you know, and there's a lot of dependencies on getting this stuff in place. You know, you have to make changes to DNS records. You need to do a lot of PowerShell. You need to understand exactly what your domain names are and all that kind of stuff. That has improved a lot. So luckily enough, we're not going to take you through those 51 steps today. We already have an environment here on my Exchange server. And you can see that before Chris was managing the Exchange environment from the online console, doing the migration there. In this instance, I have two views. So because we're federated, we have our on-premise Exchange environment, and for people who are familiar with Exchange would understand this tool. You know, so I have all my mailboxes that are located locally, and I can set up my hub transport rules and all those type of things. But I also have access to my online environment. So we're sharing a single namespace, and we can simply move users back and forth. So you can imagine that if I had an Exchange 2010 environment with 10,000 users, there'd be a lot of mailboxes there, more than I have obviously in this lab environment. So if I wanted to create a new user initially to do some testing in the cloud, it's simply a matter of right-clicking on the mailbox, on the recipient configuration, and then saying New Remote Mailbox. Which basically is saying, create a mailbox for me and the user, create that user in my on-premise Active Directory, and then go and create that mailbox in the cloud, and make sure that all those dependencies and everything is in place so that I can simply communicate to that user. So I'm going to create a user mailbox, and you can create resource mailboxes as well. and give this guy a name, and I always like test 10, because I know that I've only done 9 tests. And you have to give this guy a password as well. And click next. Yeah, so if you are in a federated mode, so you've implemented ADFS and you have a, you know, you're using ADFS for your primary authentication mechanism, if you're using a .local domain, you have to change the user's UPN to something that is routable. So it has to be contoso.com, for example, rather than contoso.local. And the way you do that is you would set a, you know, if you don't need to rename the domain, you just need to add a domain suffix for contoso.com, and then for each of the users that are going to be in the cloud, you would change your UPN to contoso.com. Ah, sorry. Good point. Thanks for picking that up.
Sorry.
So you get the choice of adding an archive. And then we create new, and we're done. So it's successfully created that. The next time, it's basically created a user within Active Directory. The next time we do a dersync, which is every 3 hours, or you can force a dersync, that user will get replicated up into the cloud, and then that mailbox will be created. So although it's finished, there's a process behind that, and it takes a little bit of time to replicate up into the cloud.
I think it's worth mentioning as well, the dersync process is... once you've actually enabled that in your tenant, you can't actually disable it again for that domain. So it just requires a bit of thought and planning around that as well.
Yep. So if I wanted to move a mailbox up into the cloud, I effectively... Yeah. There's two questions there. So once you've implemented ADFS, your local on-premise directory becomes the source of truth and handles all authentication. So the user's username and password to access the service is the same as accessing any other service on-premise. There is one caveat that if they're accessing Outlook Web Access Online or Link or whatever it is, they need to put in their UPN as a user logon name. Yeah, off some of, there's probably ways you can do that, but not out of the box. So, yeah, there is an element of organisational change and user training to teach them to use that. Typically, you'll find that username becomes the same as their mail email address. So it's, you know, it's not a massive leap, but it's still an element of change. Yeah, and over time. You know, the ADFS component will provide you with true single sign-on. So once you've authenticated to their workstation, which is part of the domain, it'll be seamless through to the service. So that, you know, that'll go away. Yep.
The dosing needs to keep running. What happens if that search from the dosing program crashes?
Yeah. So dosing is effectively a stateless device. So it's really just looking at your directory, replicating objects. So you just create another one, reinstall it, and do another dersync. Yep. All right, so, you know, I've got a user here. I'm trying to find one which is local that I haven't moved already. I think this one's one. Web user test. So he's an on-premise user. So if I was doing a migration, I could select 500 users at a time. You know, if I said my velocity and my organisation can cater and cope with 500 users to migrate it in a single time, I could select all those users. And by the way, all this is accessible via PowerShell as well, so you don't have to go to the admin console. You can run all this through PowerShell. But I just create a new remote move request, which is basically going to say, take that local on-premise mailbox and move it up into the cloud. So I say, you know, select a user, move under the mailbox, type in the fully qualified domain name, of the CAS server effectively, which is maintaining the mailbox rules there, which is stuau.com. I'll just double check that. Mixed lab. Yep, stuau.com. Where did my wizard go? Then I have to type in some credentials to you, so I'm going to use my local administrator or administrator for the domain. And click next. Again, my target is stuau.com. So I've verified that domain to my online service, so the tenant is aware of that domain. If you caught my earlier session, we went through the process of doing that. Basically, you need to own that domain. You need to go to your DNS registry or register and put in a text record, and there's a process there. And once it's verified, you can move that through. So you click on next, and then you just click on new. So it's put that request in place. It'll then go and create that request and move that mailbox up into the cloud. So I'll cancel that because we don't have time to wait for it. Okay, and the same thing. If I wanted to move a mailbox from the cloud back on premise from the online service, same process. So you select a user, you say new remote move request. And you do the same thing effectively, but it does it in reverse. So you provide the same information, and it'll move that user back on premise. Okay, so you can see it's really straightforward. Once you have that in place, you really have full control over when you can migrate and so forth. All right. So I'm going to rush through that demo quickly and move back on to the last couple of slides.
Yeah, we've got a two-minute call there.
Sorry?
We've got a two-minute call.
Yep. So where are we at?
Because that's all.
Yeah. Can we hold that and come down straight after, and we'll answer? That's a pretty involved question. So we've only got a couple of minutes. So I'll just run through this. So sorry about that. So Exchange 20 Service Pack 2. The most important thing is the more simplified creation of the Exchange Federation component. Go from 51 steps in PowerShell and all that kind of stuff down to wizard basing. So it really makes it a lot easier to use. So we're at the end. So from a session point of view, the key thing, as we've been talking about the whole time, when you're looking at moving services to the online space or the cloud space, you really need to understand what you're moving to. You need to go and look at what those service descriptions are so you know what the services you're going to get. But you also, once you've made that decision, you need to do a lot of planning. You need to do a lot of preparing. And then the migration is really the simple part. So as I said earlier, there's different ways to approach it, and based on the complexity of your organisation, you can do it very, very quickly. So if it's a 200-user organisation, you can get that done using a cutover migration, get it done in a week. However, typically, if it's above 2,000 seats, we see the start to finish, the whole process going from 3 to 6 months, and 80% of that time is in the plan and prepare phase. So it's really important that you really focus on that, understand what components you need to place, put in place, and then as you see, once you get to the point where everything's working and tested, doing the migration is very easy. It's just a couple of clicks of a mouse, and you can do some high velocity migrations there. Again, really important is understanding the impact to the end user and making sure they understand what the change is for them. So you really need a large process around organisational change and end user training and things like that as well. So thanks very much for your time. We'll take questions down the front since we've run out of time. So please come down. Yep. I don't know if you have the answer correct Twitter question.
I have tweeted back to Bob in a Bottle. But yeah, essentially the reason you need that mailbox server role is because Exchange 2003 uses public folders for FreeBSY information. And you need that there to be able to convert that so we can actually see it in the cloud. So I have responded to that tweet. Thanks a lot, guys. We didn't get through all the slides. The decks will be up. So please, if you are interested in this stuff, speak to us. Look at go through the decks in your own time, and please do the evals for us. Quite easy to do. Only takes 2 seconds of your time, and it really helps us make sure that the content you see is relevant to you. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your time, and come down the front if you have any questions. Cheers.